all children. So that's what we're talking about.
Well, Mono, I thank you not only for the painting, which is a fundamental contribution, but also for rescuing something that stopped being discussed a long time ago, and that is the fundamental importance that art has in the future of people. Nowadays, art seems to be a little left aside too. It has been crushed by the market, and this is a demonstration that there is still much to do with art to improve the world in which we live.
We should tell the young generation what is possible and what needs to be done. This is like art. I don't want to mention names here as it's a collective work, but street, territory, presence, what do we see on the street? The invasion on the street, which is also a fight to win space, which is occupying public space and giving meaning to that public space. So they started the fight to remove the statue of Manuel Baquedano until they did it. It wasn't the horse, it was the symbol. What are the monuments that are in the streets? They are the monuments of power. Ultimately, what we are doing with the poster is making this massacre visible. We put in the peripheral vision of the world what they are trying to hide. I mean, we are alive. Here is another important thing, the self-esteem. I mean, to all the neighbors, to the people who are seeing this, it's like, look at the time of the dictatorship. In the middle of the dictatorship, if someone, even if they were illiterate, didn't know how to draw, they would use the fingerprints of the detainees who disappeared or something. The detainees who were raising their voices, although it was not well made, although it was not pretty, but it was present. In other words, it was possible to make them alive. That's what's important. This is the same. I mean, all these children, imagine if they are released at this moment, if they are printed in all parts of the world, on the walls of the world, stuck in the streets, these children will be watching. I mean, it also has to do with poetry. It also has to do with creation. It also has to do with sensitivity, but it also has to do with something that is super important. How do we give this contemporaneity to art? I mean, I've not been doing murals for 50, 60 or 70 years. We are in today. This was told to me by a person who was an exhibition curator. In the exhibitions, there are frames and pictures on the walls. You can frame them, place them there, but when it comes to the streets, it is different. The posters on the streets are events and they fulfill social functions. It is social art.
Es un arte social.
Thank you very much, Alejandro, for accepting this invitation. And thank you for your art and for the relationship it has with the history of the Chilean people, but also with the history of the peoples of the world. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back. It is what you do, not what you say. Today, Palestine is a prisoner of two realities that it is almost impossible for them to talk about. On the one hand, a kind of collective schizophrenia of Zionism that despite being a country with one of the best armies in the world, which can destroy whatever it wants, which can murder whoever it wants inside and outside of Israel, which enjoys all the impunity granted by the European powers, by the United States, by Canada, but also enjoying all the immunity of the United Nations Security Council, is presented to the entire world as the victim. That is, the butchers disguised as lambs of peace. On the other hand, there are the Palestinians, who have been listening for years what we have been seeing in these videos. Statements full of content about the rights of the Palestinian people, about the two-state solution, but changes have been consolidated in the territory that make this possibility a bad joke. The Palestinians live in learned hopelessness. They no longer believe in anything. They do not believe in anyone, and they do not believe that anything that may happen in the future is going to improve their lives and give them the most basic rights as all human beings on the face of the earth. In that context, talking today about the two-state solution is painful, as it should have emerged 75 years ago when Palestine was divided. But that could only see the birth of only one. Nobody accepted the partition. The Zionists, who had benefited without asking the Palestinians, took 80% of the land of historic Palestine with 56% of the territory. And from there, they began with a macabre plan concocted from the beginning to expel the Palestinians from all their land and end up taking over all the Palestinian territory. If this continues today in Gaza, the next step will be the West Bank. Again, before the astonished gaze of an international community that is absolutely impotent and complicit for being unable to stop a genocidal regime. Today, it is necessary to reflect deeply again on the true options for peace. The changes in the territory, the impunity towards the regime of Israel, the indolence of the West, the perverse arms business making Israel feel completely powerful to carry out its projects that does not end in Palestine. If this does not change, the only possibility is to be much more radical. But being radical does not mean continuing to kill ourselves for being different. Being radical today means once and for all learning to see each other as equals, as before the arrival of Zionism in Palestine, when in that small territory, Jews, Christians, Muslims, and atheists lived together in perfect harmony, because no one felt they were in possession of either a divine project or the absolute truth or the possibility of exterminating everyone around them. Peace is the only possibility, but for that, looking at ourselves as equals and assuming that all human beings have the same rights that one considers they have is fundamental. You're now going to move on to questions from the audience in order to continue analyzing the very elusive possibilities that we see today for peace in Palestine.
Hello, Daniel. My name is Lily. I'm a sociologist and activist for the total liberation of the Palestinian people. I wanted to ask you about something that has been discussed a lot lately in the media and on social networks, and it is about the two-state solution. I wanted to first ask you if you could explain a little more to us what this is, and then I would like to know what you personally think about it.
Let's see. The two-state solution has been on the table since 1947, following the partition of Palestine. However, from the beginning, neither party accepted the partition. The Zionists, who, in quotes, were supposed to keep 56% of historic Palestine, took over 78% of the territory and expelled more than 1 million Palestinians, razing more than 500 villages with a plan that they had previously designed in detail, which was the Dale plan. Therefore, from the beginning, the lack of willingness of Zionism as a political project to accept the existence of a Palestinian state was made explicit. And finally, the Palestinians, for their part, did not accept the partition because they had not been consulted. This always reminds me of the biblical episode of Solomon, when the two women arrive saying that they were both mothers of a baby, and that Solomon, in a Solomonic solution, tells them, "Divide the baby in half." And one of the women accepts the partition, which meant the death of the baby, but the other woman says no. She accepts to give up the baby to her so that the baby can live. And Solomon, with great wisdom, takes the baby and gives it to that woman who had rejected the partition because it denoted her attitude, that she was the true mother. The other was willing to kill the baby to keep half of it, but she wasn't. It was absolutely obvious to the Palestinians that they would never accept partition because their land was being stolen without them ever being consulted. From then on, Zionism advanced. Its expansion started first from the territories occupied in the 1967 war, then the Golan Heights, Lebanon, and when one looks at the historical project of Zionism, it speaks of Eretz Yisrael, from the Nile to the Euphrates, which is also the meaning of the flag with the Star of David between the two most important river channels in the area. Therefore, one can perceive that the Zionist project goes much further, and when one hears statements like the statements we saw in the video, one realizes that they also feel like a chosen people. They have a supremacist zeal. They believe that others have no right to exist and remain anchored to a biblical mandate that called them to end the life of everything that existed on that territory. And there are some religious fanatics who still believe in writing of this type, which has also been tremendously distorted and transformed into a project that has nothing to do with the coming of the Messiah, nor with the second coming of Christ. In the last agreement that was signed, where the two states appeared as a possibility, there were several points that were essential. First, reducing the obstacles to the freedom of movement of Palestinians in the occupied territories. Reduce, dismantle, and avoid further construction of illegal settlements in the occupied territories. And the construction of a state that had to be born within a maximum period of 5 years. What we can say, 30 years after that agreement and after the assassination at the hands of an Israeli terrorist, of the Israeli prime minister who signed that agreement, is that the obstacle to freedom of movement have multiplied almost tenfold, that illegal settlements have grown sevenfold, and that a security ring of illegal Israeli settlers has ended up forming around Jerusalem al-Quds, which has always been considered the capital of both parts. With all of this, in addition to the division into sectors A, B, and C, where only territories A have sovereignty, the administrative sovereignty of the Palestinians would be less than 18% of the original territory of Palestine, which is made up of Batistanis and also subdivided by the Wall of Infamy, which the International Court of Justice has defined as illegal. Given this background, one could ask what possibility there is of thinking about both states. Here, I believe that perhaps the mistake of the Palestinian leadership lies in signing an agreement without taking into consideration the logic of its adversary, the psychology of the adversary. Zionism has never told the truth. It has never acted with humanity and honesty. It has always lied to everyone and has educated the children of Israel to deeply hate the Palestinian people, so much so that by the time an agreement has been made, they have come to think that they are not human beings and that they are inferior. Can we think of peaceful coexistence with a state that has educated its citizens like this? For this reason, as it was the original plan of the PLO, the peace plan for the Palestinians has been a single plurinational state for anyone who wanted to live in and fight in a territory where there was no discrimination based on race, color, or religion. This is a fundamental letter of the PLO, and it is what has been put back on the table today when what happened in the territory and what happened with the hypocrisy of the United States and Europe have made any possibility of two states disappear. Well, this is too much change for the Israeli society, because furthermore, when faced with a question like yours, I could not say in what language, which is the house of being, do we speak? In the language of Zionism or in the language of the Palestinians? If we spoke in the language of Zionism, which is unacceptable, we would say in Israel there are no innocent civilians. If we spoke in the language of Zionism, we would say if what happened after October the 7th is justified by what happened on October the 7th, then everything that happened before October the 7th would justify the October 7th attack. This is not the way. The only possibility is to dare to see each other as equals, to dare to live together in absolute equality of duties and rights in a territory that has always welcomed all peoples who, regardless of their interest, intended to control the world. All of them have passed through Palestine, inhabited Palestine, and then left. What is clear is that the Palestinians were there before the first invader arrived, and they will surely be there after the last one leaves. Thanks, Lily.
Hola, Daniel.
Hello, Daniel. I'm Manuel Hidalgo, leader of IMA, the International Migrants Alliance, a network of grassroots migrant and refugee organizations worldwide, and the National Immigrant Coordination, which we also deeply sympathize with the struggle of the Palestinian people. I want to ask you, what are the reasons? Why have you become immigrants? What are the conditions to achieve peace in Palestine? And what role does the international community have in this objective?
Manuel, tu pregunta es tremendamente interesante, pero también muy compleja porque obliga.
Manuel, your question is tremendously interesting, but also very complex, because it forces us to address the Middle East conflict as part of a global North-South conflict that is on a global scale. Transnational capital, when it is in times of contraction of its rate of profit, according to Marx, is dedicated to destroying productive factors in such a way as to also put an end to any obstacle that allows it to take over all the markets, all the natural resources, and everything that can allow them to continue the process of accumulation and concentration of wealth. Therefore, one has to understand the question of Palestine in a global framework that also explains the non-escalating war, which explains the intervention in various Latin American countries where transnational capital tries to overthrow governments that seek an autonomous alternative and be owners of their own resources. And in that context, what one should look at as a basic condition is that a world that does not have to go from being unipolar to multipolar is truly established. It has to go from being unipolar to multilateral. That is, a world where there are no poles of development that live at the expense of impoverishing the rest of the world, but rather there is truly a world where all states are peers, have the same rights and the same duties towards the international community. Of course, when one focuses on the West Asia, this requires recognizing all the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people, which include the right to return and to self-determination, which is the first collective right of peoples recognized by the United Nations. The same United Nations that in 1947, along with establishing that right, is the first to violate it when it divides Palestine without consulting the Palestinians. But in addition to the rights of return and self-determination, there is the inalienable rights of the establishment of a Palestinian state in Palestine with Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital. These are inalienable national rights.
The
only thing the Palestinian people want is to live in peace. It has never moved outside its territory to invade any nation on the planet. It has never expelled from Palestine anyone who came to ask for shelter and solidarity. Zionism came to destroy the Palestinian people and to deprive them of all their ancestral rights. I want to thank the entire production team for the wonderful work that they have done on this first season. I invite you to meet us in the second season of A Window to Palestine.
Ventana a Palestina.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear listeners, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents and commentaries of chapter Qasas, the 28th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back with you after you listen to some of the verses of this chapter we're going to talk about in this program.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
طاسين
طاسين ميم
تلك آيات الكتاب المبين
These are verses of the clear book.
نَتْلُو عَلَيْكَ مِنْ نَبَإِ مُوسَى وَفِرْعَوْنَ بِالْحَقِّ لِقَوْمٍ يُؤْمِنُونَ
We recite to you from the news of Moses and Pharaoh in truth for a people who believe.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing the third verse of chapter Qasas, and it says that we are going to mention to you some of the parts of the story of Moses and Pharaoh in truth for a people who believe. Now, regarding this verse, the very beginning thing we said we have to note is the fact that it starts saying نَتْلُوا عَلَيْكَ مِنْ نَبَئِ مُوسَى. We are going to recite to you only a part of the story. This min points to the fact that this is whatever is mentioned in this chapter is only a part of what has happened throughout the history. So, in this regard, we can mention the fact that different verses of the Holy Quran are pointing to the story of Prophet Moses, but it seems that the Holy Quran has had different approaches regarding specific parts of the story or specific aspects of the story of Prophet Moses. And wherever deemed necessary, this part is brought up and mentioned by the Holy Quran. So, this verse, as you may have noted, says, نَتْلُوا عَلَيْكَ مِنْ نَبَئِ مُوسَى وَفِرْعَوْنَ بِالْحَقِّ. And the application of the word بِالْحَقِّ, in truth, in these verses, points to the fact that whatever has been mentioned here is free from any superstition, free from any kind of content made in the old fables and false matters. It is a recitation with truth and exact reality. It is implicitly mentioning that there are some different versions of the story of Prophet Moses which are filled with superstitions, which are filled with false matters, and this makes hard for you to distinguish from the truth and untruth. So, the application of the phrase لِقَوْمٍ يُؤْمِنُونَ after, right after the word بِالْحَقِّ, for people who believe, is an emphasis on this fact, that those believers who were under pressure at the time in Mecca, like and the like of them, should reach to this fact by hearing this story, that how abundant the enemy's power, number of persons, and their forces is, and how the number of believers is apparently little, and they are under pressure, the power of Allah is the one that has the power. The power of Allah is above all. They must not feel weakness in themselves. So this is only one simple responsibility of such verse.
نَتْلُوا عَلَيْكَ مِنْ نَبَإِ مُوسَى وَفِرْعَوْنَ بِالْحَقِّ لِقَوْمٍ يُؤْمِنُونَ.
So, dear listeners, regarding this third verse of chapter Qasas, up to now we have mentioned a couple of points. The first is the application of the word min that points to the fact that whatever is mentioned in this chapter is only a part of the concerning adventures of Moses and Pharaoh. Now, also the application of the word bilhaq points to the very fact that there are some different versions of the stories regarding Prophet Moses that are actually mixed with unrealities, which are mixed with superstitions. And also, the last point, which is the most important, I think, is the application of the phrase لِقَوْمٍ يُؤْمِنُونَ. Because this verse was revealed when there were some people under pressure at that time in Mecca. So these people are the very ones that should reach the true meanings of these verses. Why? Because they were truly under pressure in Mecca and they were facing many difficulties at that time. Now, what will happen if they hear about a prophet, a divine prophet that had many people being under oppression at that time? The people of Moses had many problems, they had faced many difficulties, and the true believers to Moses were the ones that actually gained power. So, they have to note the fact that they must not feel weakness in themselves. The Lord who caused Moses to be brought up in the bosom of Pharaoh to destroy him. This is the Lord who made the oppressed slaves as the governors on earth. He was the one who made the cruel oppressors abject, mean, and annihilated, actually.
This is the kind of Lord who protected a little baby in the rushing waves of water. This is the one who buried thousands of thousands strong people of Pharaoh inside the sea. And this is the very Lord who is able to save you. There is no different Lord. This is exactly that very Lord. So, the main target of these verses is the believers. لِقَوْمٍ يُؤْمِنُونَ, the verse says. And this recitation has been accomplished for them. Yes, they are the believers. They are the ones who can be actually inspired, who can be enlivened by these verses. They are the ones who will find their way to the aim among the mass of difficulties. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful, and may great peace and blessing be upon Prophet and his household. Assalamu alaikum, my dear audience, brothers and sisters, and welcome back to the series of Talks for Humanity. I'm Hamza Azizi. In previous episodes, we have talked about the ideal image that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala illustrates about an Islamic family. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala emphasizes that to be able to understand the main ideal image of a family, we have to understand that the core point of this family is faith and communicative worshipping. In chapter Zumar, verse 15, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala emphasizes that فَعْبُدُوا مَا شِئْتُم مِّن دُونِهِ. Worship whatever you wish beside Him. قُلْ إِنَّ الْخَاسِرِينَ الَّذِينَ خَسِرُوا أَنفُسَهُمْ وَأَهْلِيهِمْ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ. If you want to find the losers, the ones who have lost in this universe, the losers are those who ruin themselves and their families on the day of resurrection. So you see that not only people are going to be regretful about what happened to them on the day of judgment, they also are going to lose their family in case that they did not do their own duties with regard to their family. Since then, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أَلَا ذَٰلِكَ هُوَ الْخُسْرَانُ الْمُبِينُ. This is the is a manifest loss. Okay, so let's continue with the next topic about family. In a family, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not raise enmity between the people, but at the same time, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is realistic. He's not going to cheat the human beings. No. In a right place and in a right occasion, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala emphasizes that you along with your own family must be careful about what is going to happen to your family. As we said before, قُوا أَنفُسَكُمْ وَأَهْلِيكُمْ نَارًا. Not only you think about your safety and saving yourself from the hellfire, you also have to think about your family being rescued from the hellfire. That's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, take care of them, but there's a but. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at the same time tries to open the mind and the eyes of the ones who read these verses and the ones who follow the instructions of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala about a family. So we will follow that after a short break.
لطيف خبير سميع بصير جالي راقب مجيب غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد. وآل محمد يا مسلمين صلوا عليه اللهم صل على محمد صلوا عليه يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Welcome back, my dear audience. This is Hamza Azizi from IRIB English Radio in the series of For Humanity. We have been talking about the ideal image of a family. We said that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala both emphasizes on the significance of a family and at the same time warns the human beings from the dangers that might come from the families. That's why in chapter Taghabun, verse 14, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, inna min azwajikum wa awladikum aduwan lakum. You have faith, indeed, among your spouses and children, you have enemies. That might sound a little bit strange to any people at the beginning. Says, okay, why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks like that, that we are so improved and we try not to get any struggles among us. So why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that inna min azwajikum wa dhurriyat wa awladikum aduwwan lakum. Your spouses and your children are, some of them are going to be your enemy. فَاحْذَرُوهُمْ. Be careful about them. By the way, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in this verse at the very beginning says that, okay, every human being has his own duties, whether in pilgrimage of Hajj or other occasions. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, in a family, although you are following your faith faith-related instructions, the instructions of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But you have to be careful that the devil is conspiring against you. He's trying to use every means in order to temptate and in order to make you switch the right path to the other paths. So that's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, من أزواجكم وأولادكم عدو لكم. Some of them, some of your spouses, some of your children are going to be your enemy. Why? Because the devil would temptate them and would use them to make you forget the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, by raising different things, different manifestations of the worldly manners. They, whether consciously or unconsciously, they are taking you to the hellfire. They are taking to the disobedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and obedience of the devil. So that's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Inna min azwajikum wa awladikum aduwwan lakum fahdharuhum. They might be, I do not say all of them, there might be some spouses and some children who are going to turn to the enemy of their parents or father. Thank you. Walhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen.
Jannah, Jannah, it's all I ever wish for. This life is not eternal, but the next will last forever. Jannah, Jannah, it's all I ever wish for. Oh God, please don't deprive me a blissful life eternally. Shown in front of you, and no one will be beside me. I'll be standing on my own. Blessing me with your mercy is all I'm hoping for. Oh Allah, make my wishes come true. Jannah, Jannah, it's all I ever wish for. But the next will last forever. Jannah, Jannah, it's all I ever wish for. Oh God, please don't deprive me of a blissful life eternally.
Economic divide.
The U.S. presidential election 2024 had a winner. The now president-elect Donald Trump. Record amounts of money were poured into this election cycle, including, of course, the presidential election. Billions of dollars, not by ordinary Americans, obviously, but by billionaires, shell companies, super PACs, and dark money. And what about the return? And is this a free and fair election, by the way? What about the 40% who did not vote? Let's take a look at some of the highlights coming up. Money in the U.S. elections 2024. Presidential race, $5.51 billion. Congressional races, $10.29 billion. The total cost of $15.8 billion. Wow. Then we're going to take a look at PACs versus super PACs. Super PACs, they get around donation amounts thanks to Citizen United. And big donors, there were 144 billionaires who spent large sums of money. Then we change track and take a look at what percentage actually voted. Between 50 to 60% of the eligible voters did go out and vote, but why didn't the 40% vote? Many say it won't make a difference.
There used to be a time in the U.S. when money and politics was at levels that reflected the will of Americans in choosing their next president. Yes, corporations were there making their contributions, return for favors, especially legislation that was made through their congressmen and women. but now the amount of money poured into the U.S. elections has reached epic proportions, more than $15 billion. That kind of money is enough to help poverty in the U.S. Or how about the over 35 million Americans who are on food stamps through SNAP? Nevertheless, that money was poured into the coffers of the two U.S. presidential candidates. And for those hoping that the U.S. would break free from the prevailing corporatism driving its current geopolitical dominance, no chance of that. Billionaires have donated at least $695 million, or about 18% of the total money that was raised in this election cycle. Donald Trump was particularly dependent on American billionaires, with about a third of the money raised during his campaign and through support groups, which came from billionaires, compared to about 6% for the money raised by groups supporting candidate Kamala Harris. Overall, at least 144 people on the list of about 800 American billionaires compiled on Forbes actually contributed to the U.S. presidential election.
Time to take a look at some of the social media posts. First up, Americans, why does everyone care so much about our elections? U.S. military bases, 750 bases in at least 80 countries, 173,000 troops deployed in 159 countries. Maybe that's the reason. Next, with Election Day just around the corner, here is who is funding this historic election. Well, in this case, the election has come and gone, but it's worth taking a look at this entry, which was projected to surpass $15.9 billion, which it did in total spending. Democrats, Michael Bloomberg, $43.16 million, and Reid Garrett Hoffman, $32.37 million. And for the Republicans, Timothy Mellon, $172.04 million, with Miriam Adelson, $136.84 million. Next, pro-Israeli lobby AIPAC, they spent over $100 million in 2024 U.S. presidential election. And both campaigns in the U.S. presidential race have been bankrolled hundreds of millions of dollars by prominent elites. Contrary to the rhetoric of change espoused by both, American politics still operate on the same old engine of U.S. corporate interests. All right, those were some of the posts that we picked. Let me introduce our guest for the first segment of our Q&A. We have Diane Sayre, an independent candidate for the U.S. Senate from New York State, who joins us. She's also a political analyst. Diane Sayre, welcome to Economic Divide. All right, my first question to you, the outside spending on 2024 federal elections. Now, that has hit a record of $4.5 billion, and half of that money is comes from places that it's not disclosed in terms of the groups of who is doing the donating. And then you have independent political committees, such as the super PACs. I mean, it's been reported they've received over $1 billion from shell companies and also dark money inclusive. What does this all mean? Tell us more about the money trail here.
Well, I think the process by which American elections are controlled is extremely undemocratic. There was an enormous amount thrown into this election by special interest groups, particularly by groups like AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which, if we had fair standards, should have to register as a foreign agent. Congressmen and candidates who receive a lot of money should really have to register as being influenced by another country. So the purpose of this money, of course, is to control policy. Now, that being said, I'm not sure it's going to work, because 4.7 billion people on the planet, that is nations that represent the BRICS process and the expanding BRICS process, are changing the policy already. And there's nothing that the Anglo-American elites are going to be able to do to prevent that, except to try and unleash the most destructive conflict and hardship on on these nations, and I still don't think they're going to be successful. I think that's what makes the war danger so great.
All right, thank you for that. Let me bring in our next guest. We have Gabriel Aquino joining us. Gabriel Aquino is a political analyst with the U.S. presidential and Senate campaign, and he also has additional experience in nonprofit donor relations, communications, marketing, and policy research also is part of his resume. Gabriel Aquino, welcome to Economic Divide. All right, my question to you has to deal with the money that's being spent in these elections, which has hit such a record amount in some respects. We're looking at, for example, $4.5 billion coming from groups that don't fully disclose the source of their funding. We're also looking at super PACs. They've reportedly received over $1 billion from shell companies, also dark money that's included in there. I mean, some of this money should go to the people and the homeless and the people who are hungry, who are in dire need of this food. Can you tell us all this money means? What does that represent, do you think?
Quite a few changes have occurred via the Federal Elections Commission in the past several decades, but one of the most significant ones was Citizens United Supreme Court decision in 2012 that essentially shifted the recognition of donations from just people and essentially level the playing field between donations between people and corporations. And so essentially corporations had this new financial right to make donations that were, even though they weren't as, weren't in the same size, same volume as small donations from individuals, they could make them in abundance. So what happens is there is these political action committees, and within the political action committees, there are however many members that exist within it. And then within that, each one of those members has different accounts. So through those different accounts is how these massive contributions are able to go through.
It's time now for the Infinite News section of the program. Well, with the first entry, the new U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, what is the plan of action for him? Lots of news have come out on this. One, tariffs. I'm sure you heard of that. Immigrants also, and fiscal policy. This entry went on to say Trump's second term as U.S. president is what those three factors will be involved at the top of his list. Now, how far tariffs go? Well, that depends on how far, in the case of China, and as President Xi is willing to negotiate with the U.S. and with Trump. Tariffs of at least 60% on Chinese imports and tariffs of 10 to 20% on all other foreign goods would raise duties to levels not seen since the Great Depression. That's not good news. One has to wait and see. Next up, actually, we've dedicated all of our InfoNews entries to the election of former President Trump, who is now the president-elect. This particular one is the impact of Trump that it may have on the global economy. It's a projection, but it says Trump's re-election is plunging the global economy into uncertainty, and it went on to say global GDP could take a hit and that emerging economies would suffer if Trump imposes these big tariffs that he's been touting about. Will he follow through on his threats? Again, that remains to be seen. Then, Iran's reaction to the election of Trump. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian expects no shift in U.S. policy. Iran has prioritized developing relations with Islamic and neighboring countries. And also, Iran has called Trump's victory an opportunity for the U.S. to reassess the past wrong policies. This entry also looks at Trump's impact on the world economy, where it says Trump's return to the White House with his protectionist policies poses threats for the global economy. There are prospects of new trade wars, resurgent inflation, and also slower growth. And the reason why we actually chose this entry is the impact on the EU, where it said it would be losses to accrue. This entry projects $533 billion through 2029, $749 billion for the U.S. also, and then $827 billion for China. So you can see that really not that great a news for Trump and his election when it comes to the world economy based on the eyes of the entries that we just presented to you. That brings us to an end for our InfoNews section.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Let's find out what our guests think. Let me bring them back. First up is Diane Sayre, independent candidate for U.S. Senate from New York State, and she is also a political analyst. Diane Sayre, welcome back to Economic Divide. In the case of Republicans, we just looked at companies who made the most donations. Why do you think that they chose these companies, the Republican Party, as opposed to the Democratic Party? Unless when you make these types of contributions, you obviously want the return favor, so to speak, when money is being donated that way?
Well, I think you have the answer in your question clearly. And I have to tell you, I didn't look at who was giving the money that closely. I know big groups like Goldman Sachs and all these various big financial institutions throw a lot of money around, as do certain billionaires like Miriam Adelson and others. So I think they gave a lot of money to the Republicans because they are hoping to somehow get the Trump presidency under control.
All right, let's take a look at another issue. Let's switch gears here, and that's about the demographics. We're looking at overall how average median of 40% of Americans don't actually vote. And in terms of the breakdown, you're looking at many who actually are in favor of the independents. But when it comes to the Americans who don't vote, that's the question to you. Why do you think that is? Or is it because they've been disillusioned by both parties in the first place?
Well, the answer to your first question is very simple. Fraud, massive vote fraud. I experienced it myself both 2 years ago and this time. And it's not just me. I look at people like Jill Stein, where the state of Michigan had 10% uncommitted votes in the Democratic primary against Biden as a protest to the genocide going on in Gaza. And Jill Stein somehow ends up with below 1% in that state. I don't think that's credible, really. Nor do I believe it to be credible that Dennis Kucinich, who already was in the Congress, ended up with only 11% of the vote.
All right, thank you for that. Let's bring back Gabriel Aquino, political analyst with the U.S. presidential and Senate campaign. Gabriel Aquino, welcome back. The U.S. voting demographics is what I'd like to ask you about. We're looking at how many are disillusioned by both the Republican and the Democratic Party, and perhaps that's my lead up to the question as to maybe that is why many Americans, 40% roughly, sometimes more, do not vote when the presidential elections come about. What reasons do you find behind that? Is it because, again, they're disillusioned with those two parties?
Gotcha. Yeah, so something that is very sort of novel to American politics is that essentially we have these two choices, and while they may provide a bevy or variety of the issues that we find ourselves aligning with, in many instances, the parties also choosing to go with a major party also kind of compels one or to compromise on something they also believe in. So the rise of third parties tends to come from the material conditions of the voters not being addressed. And while, unfortunately, in America, there are there is this narrative that voting for a third party is ultimately going to hurt one of the major parties that, you know, at the end of the day, you'll just settle for, that you would prefer at the end of the day. But and in this most recent election, those third parties, once again, they really, while they did make a showing, and they certainly did affect the outcome of certain states and the ways that they went for electoral for the Electoral College, once again, they really didn't make that much of a dent to speak of.
Outside spending also hit a record on 2024 federal elections at $4.5 billion, with more than half of that spending coming from groups that do not fully disclose the source of their funding. Meanwhile, the record-breaking spending on the 2024 presidential race was driven by super PACs that were allied with both major party candidates and was fueled by dark money from anonymous sources. Conveniently, unlimited amount of money can be done through these super PACs instead of directly to the nominee, just another way of getting around maximum campaign donations. These are exactly the reasons why many Americans are disenchanted with the voting process, including the choice between the two parties. They feel that they have been abandoned by the political system in the U.S. since they do not see any change in their economic status.
Do you trust the system which exists now?
Honestly, not so much. I think there's still a lot of flaws, a lot of ill confidence in it. A lot of the cases when they were brought to court were just denied based on standing. They weren't given a fair chance, I believe.
I think whoever wins was going to be chaotic. I don't feel that either party or either person represents all of us equally. And that never happens, but it is what it is. And I just hear there'll be chaos. I think there's going to be people challenged to vote, and people my age don't want it. We want calm. We want things happening.
Regardless of what party is in control, the lives of people who struggle to make ends meet don't improve. For example, many who are on government assistance of any kind suffer, since benefits have been cut time and again, which is why, even though there are millions of people who are eligible to vote, decide not to do so.
Hello, and welcome to the Quick Tech section. I'm Kiarash Punemati. When it comes to the U.S. presidential election, the number of Americans was not the reason for the U.S. president-elect Donald Trump's win. It was the number of electors, part of the Electoral College system. Even though at the end the U.S. president-elect did win both the popular vote and the number of electors, in the U.S., it's not the number of votes that decided the winner of the U.S. presidential election, but the number of electors. In the U.S. president-elect Donald Trump's case, he did win both the electors and the number of votes, as outlined here. But one thing that is not talked about as much when it comes to the U.S. presidential election is about the voter turnout. And what about the states which voted the least? Why did Americans not vote as much as the rest of the U.S.? First, a look at the number of Americans eligible to vote, roughly 244 million. And when it comes to the number of that actually voted, about 145 million voted. That means about 100 million did not vote. About 40% of Americans. Pretty high, considering the way the media painted a picture of record turnouts. It turns out that in any given U.S. election, between 35 and 60% of eligible voters don't cast a ballot. The United States may be a democracy, but every year many Americans don't bother voting at all. It turns out that, on average, 40% of all Americans eligible to vote don't participate at all, a lower percentage than in most other Western democracies, a percentage that has more or less repeated itself in previous elections. The U.S. states with the lowest average turnout rates are pictured here. The state's 2024 turnout of registered voters was lower than the past two presidential elections. That is it for this Quick Tech section.
When companies, wealthy donors, and dark money flood an election like the U.S. presidential election, promises are made for the money being donated. Many companies want legislation, for example, passed for their benefit and their stockholders, and other favors which maybe we don't obviously know about. And in view of the previous elections, many to not have served the benefit of the Americans. Which explains why around 40% of Americans probably find it that it's not worth even voting in a democratic exercise that they don't believe in. That does it for this edition of the program.